Okay. Your marriage is your best investment for 2009. Now, how many here are married or want to be married? Oh, good. I got the right audience. That's good. I'd like to kind of set the event. It was sad to hear, as Brian talked about, there's not much difference between Christian marriages and secular marriages. I don't know if that came as a surprise to you. Surprised me. I'm saying if there's anywhere we as Christians could shine, it would be in the area of marriages. And that encouraged me to want to speak to you today, because I really believe that we can do a better job. In fact, I don't know if you've noticed it or not, but Christianity is being somewhat marginalized. And marriage is an endangered species. Now, if it were under the federal control, we would probably have some help from the federal government, but we don't, right? It's fascinating, interesting to me that we have, even in California, such a push to change what God ordained, that secularism and what I would call the demonic are trying to change our concept of marriage, trying to dilute it, trying to marginalize it, trying to redefine it. And yet, as Christians, I believe that it's the best thing we've got going as far as showing the world what God's all about. Because it's in that relationship that we have with our wives that we're able to show others how to live. And this morning, I'm going to talk about the Old Testament, a story in the Old Testament, but it's a story we all know, but it's a story that we need to continue to remember and apply it to ourselves. In 1 Peter chapter 2, 11, remember it said, "Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in this world to abstain from sinful desires which war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that, though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us." So this command is, we're to be different. And as Brian said before, to be holy is to be set aside. The nation of Israel was set aside for God as a teaching model. And he set up all kinds of kosher things, the law, and it was all designed to be different than the neighborhood. They were to be different. In fact, the differences are seen in the difference between life and death. Those things that are life-giving are separated from those things that are death-giving. And therefore, you couldn't mix certain clothing styles. And it was because one represented death, the other represented life. And in a way, we as Christians represent life. We are the embodiment of God's promise that he would send a Savior and that he would bring in his kingdom and his kingdom would be restored. But you know, in Matthew 24, Jesus also promised that there would be persecution, just as in the day of Peter. Remember, Peter was writing to this church in Turkey, and he was talking to a church that was being oppressed, being persecuted. But in the end days, that same sort of persecution is coming our way. Now, I don't know if you believe it. I tend to believe it. I think we're getting closer, not further away from the end days. So the schedule of Christianity being popular, we're coming to an end, folks. I think that we need to roll up our sleeves and face the fact that in the days ahead, we're going to be less popular, not more popular. And it's going to be harder to get our message across, just as in most magazines, and we get the sense that Christianity is passé, that it no longer applies. It no longer is meaningful. It is a story, a myth, a way of looking at life that was patristic in that it oppressed women and it did all these kinds of things. And now we're a much more enlightened world. You know, we are, we know how to make each other happy, and really we don't have to obey God. And why don't we just become our own gods? Well, this should remind us of a story back in Genesis. But before we get there, I thought it'd be interesting to share with you an email that I got, and it was this. I don't know if you've seen this, but let me read it to you. It says, this female's installing software. She says, dear tech support, last year I upgraded from boyfriend 5.0 to husband 1.0 and noticed a distinct slowdown in the overall system performance, particularly in the flower and jewelry applications, which operated flawlessly under boyfriend 5.0. Now, in addition, husband 1.0 uninstalled many of the valuable programs such as Romance 9.5 and Personal Attention 6.5, and then installed undesirable programs such as NBA 5.0, NFL 3.0, and Golf Clubs 4.1. Yeah. Conversation 8.0 no longer runs, and House Cleaning 2.6 simply crashes the system. Please note that I've tried running Nagging 5.3 to fix these problems, but to no avail. What can I do? Signed, Desperate. Okay, well, here's the response back. Dear Desperate, first, keep in mind that Boyfriend 5.0 is an entertainment package, while Husband 1.0 is an operating system. Please enter command, I thought you loved me, HTML, and try to download Tier 6.2, and do not forget to install the Guilt 3.0 update. If that application works as designed, Husband 1.0 should then automatically run the applications Jewelry 2.0 and Flowers 3.5. However, remember, overuse of the above applications can cause Husband 1.0 to default to Grumpy Silence 2.5, Happy Hour 7.0, and Beer 6.1. Please note that Beer 6.1 is a very bad program and that will download the farting and snoring loudly beta. Whatever you do, do not, under any circumstance, install Mother-in-Law 1.0. It runs a virus in the background that will eventually seize control of all your system resources. In addition, please do not attempt to reinstall Boyfriend 5.0 program. These are unsupported applications and will crash Husband 1.0. In summary, Husband 1.0 is a great program, but it does have limited memory and cannot learn new applications quickly. You might consider buying additional software to improve your memory and performance. We recommend Cooking 3.0 and Hot Lingerie 7.7. Good luck, tech support. Is that right? Yeah, okay. Now, when we tend to think of marriage, I don't know about you, but nobody really handed me a book and said, okay, this is what it means to be a husband. My father really never sat down with me and said, hey, this is what it takes to be a husband. This is what you should know about women. This is what you should do. So we all kind of walk into marriage kind of blindly, and some of us think of it this way. I think I can make you happy if I can get funded, you know? Most of us walked into marriage with that kind of thought, that if I just made enough money, my wife would be happy. And you know what? In this area, it works pretty well. Now, I've been a therapist, psychologist for 27 years, and what I noticed was that as long as men made money, women were fairly happy. But back in the 80s, remember the 80s, when everything crashed, much like today? When the money ran out, so did the women, at least what I found in my practice, is that women will put up with a lot, but if there isn't a basic foundation to the relationship, which includes having a connection, being attached, having communication, and being able to have a knit family, money will only last so long. And then it falls apart. So, nowadays, we're at that same intersection. Now, we get to show the world what it takes to love our wives, what it takes to be in a relationship that is honoring to God. And so we have a unique opportunity. As the world is falling apart, we get to give the world hope. We get to look like the hope that the world needs to be able to love our wives. And believe me, nothing spreads quicker among women than those women whose husbands are doing well, not financially, but how they're relating to them. Now, we seem to think as men that's our only value, is that if we're giving money and having money and making money. But I said that's a small part of what marriage is about. And the story I'd like to talk about today is one that you're very familiar with. It's about Adam and Eve. Now remember, there's three parts to this story. We're going to talk a little about the center part. The first part is that God has created the world and has waited to create the pinnacle of his creation, which is man. Now he grabs some earth and forms man out of this earth and blows into his nostrils breath of life. And therefore God makes man different than the rest of his creation. He's made from earth, he's kind of lowly, but right beside it he is breathed into God's breath. So man not only has a physical being, he is a relationship being, and he's a spiritual being. And he has a particular relationship with God because God forms a garden, Garden of Eden. God's own heart. It's the centerpiece, and it's a little bit east. And I think the reference point is actually probably Israel. It's east of Israel. And he puts man in this garden. He gives him a job to do. He's a cultivator. He's a farmer. But you know what else he is? He protects the garden. So man now has authority and responsibility. But God looks at him and says, you know what? This isn't good. There's something missing here. He needs somebody. He needs to be in relationship. And so God parades before Adam all of the animals, and Adam names them. Now, in the Old Testament Hebrew understanding of naming, it's a way of not just labeling somebody, but it's to basically describe what they are, to show what kind of relationship you have with them. And so Adam is paraded all of these animals in front of him. None of them are suitable as helpmates to him. And so God puts Adam to sleep, and out of his side he forms woman. And of course we know the story about Eve. Adam looks at her and can't believe how gorgeous she is, how much she compliments him. And he is, you know, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. He's able to see in her not only himself, but this completion. And so God does a very good thing. He gives man a helpmate. And even before this, we know in Eden that there are trees. There are trees that are providing food and nourishment, but there are two trees in particular. There's a tree of good and evil, but it's probably better translated good and bad. And then there's the tree that gives eternal life. Now, it's interesting. We hear about these two trees, and Adam has this woman that is now his completion. And we come upon chapter 3, verse 1, and we find that there is a serpent in this garden, and he's crafty. Now, the serpent, as it's translated in Greek, is nakash, which means the shining one. Shining, glittering, shining, beautiful, but he's a serpent. What do we know about reptilians? How many of you have picked up a snake? Yeah? Ever had a rattlesnake in your hand? Little beady eyes looking at you? You know, it's you kind of look at this beautiful animal, but it's got danger written all over it. And most of us, you know, have this innate fear of snakes. You know, that there's this, you know, they seem sneaky and you don't know what they're going to do, and they slither and they attack and they do all kinds of things. And but there's this serpent who is craftier than all the wild animals that the Lord has made, and he said to the woman, so Eve is in the garden, but she comes to this place where the serpent is, and the serpent we think is near the tree of good and evil. And we know that God said to Adam, you can't eat from this tree. And obviously Adam must have told his wife that you can't eat from this tree. But in doing that, what we know about man is that man had free will. Because being able to be restricted, we know that Adam understands that he can do a lot of things in the garden, but God restricts one thing, eating from this tree. And he's told his wife, but we find that his wife isn't a very good listener. Because Satan, or it'll eventually be Satan in the New Testament, who is our adversary, the serpent says, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? He asked Eve that. Now Eve replies, the woman said to the serpent, we may eat from the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God did say, you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or surely you will die. You won't die, the serpent said to the woman, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be open and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. When the woman saw that the fruit was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband, and listen carefully, who was with her, and he ate it. Then the eyes of both of them were open, and they realized that they were naked, so they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. Now this is an unusual scene. We have an animal from the field that is talking and speaking to woman. And the first conversation that we hear that woman has is with the serpent. And he asks her a question. Did God really say that? Did he really say that you couldn't eat from the fruit of the... And she corrects him. She basically says, no, God said we could eat from the trees. He just said we couldn't eat from this particular tree or touch it. Now, that's not what God said. God said, didn't say anything about touching it. And so Eve makes a categorical mistake. She adds to God's word. And she is susceptible because she is talking to a serpent. She's not talking to her husband. She's not talking to God. She's talking to a serpent. Now, this serpent is leading her to a path. Now, we don't understand why. Why is this serpent doing this? Now, this is kind of between the white spaces. Remember when God led all of those animals before Adam? I think the serpent was one of them. He's an animal of the field. He wasn't chosen. And yet, he is different than all of the other animals. He speaks. He talks. But this is an important clue because one of the chief weapons that Satan has is his speech. Okay? When Satan talks, we have to be prepared to respond. And we understand that the way Eve responded was to answer his questions. Now, when Jesus was out in the wilderness and he was approached by Satan, which is a parallel to this, how did Jesus respond to Satan? Scripture. Exactly. He knew that the shining one is clever. Now, we tend to think, I can handle Satan. He's not a problem. But even our Lord Jesus Christ approaches Satan very specifically. He deals with him with God's word. But does Eve? No, Eve doesn't do that. And she entices her husband to also eat. Now, let's paint the picture a little bit, because remember, God has just made this woman for man. She is incredibly good looking. She is incredibly a soulmate to him. And he is right beside her when this is happening. And what happens? He says nothing. Now, why is this important for us? Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. A, because with our wives, we live out some of the same things that Adam and Eve do. We look at this as a story of not only Adam and Eve, but this is a story of us. That we live in a fallen world, and that we are in danger. We have an enemy. And we have a relationship with God. We've got a relationship with people. But we have certain failures. Adam's failure was silence. Now, I think that there are two possible situations that we fall into as husbands. We can either be too passive, or we can be too demanding. Now, both of those are extremes. In Adam's case, he said nothing. And you know what? His job was to guard the garden. His first question should have been, "What are you doing here? You serpent, you're out in the field." The serpent is sitting there talking to his wife, and he's not saying anything. Now, this falls into the category, you know, that we are providers, we're priests, we're protectors, and we're this prototype. This falls under the category of protector. We are protectors of our wives. Therefore, God has put us in authority. Just as he put us in authority in the garden, we have authority that we cannot avoid. Now, many of us would rather just make money, you know, and just let, you know, the woman take care of the home and, you know, make sure everything's working out. But you know what? That would be the same thing that happened with Adam. That he was going to go till, but not take care of the family. So one of the things that we as husbands need to do, we have to understand our wives, but we also have to understand the territory and who the enemy is. Now, Eve, of course, we know, felt that God was not good enough. That what God had provided and what God had arranged, it was a pretty nice setup, you know. I think Eden was a fairly good setup. All the food you could eat, not a lot of problems, there's no neighbors, there's no mother-in-laws. It's beautiful, you know. But Eve is tempted by something. Eve is tempted by knowing. Knowing good and evil. Now, Satan says that the real problem is that God doesn't want you to be like him. And, you know, God's kind of a spoiled sport. And he doesn't want to share. And so if you just eat from this fruit, you'll be like him. And actually, life will be really good. And so Eve believes this. Now, what does happen, their eyes do open. But they're open to their nakedness. Now, the nakedness, I don't think, is just physical nakedness, although what I think it helped made them realize is how insignificant they were. And the story goes on, as you remember, that they put these fig leaves together and God comes calling. Calls out for them. And they're hiding. And they're ashamed of their nakedness. And we have this blame battle between Adam and Eve and the serpent about who's to blame for this mess. Well, it's not unlike most marriages that I see where we have a real problem with blaming what goes on in our relationships. And God institutes some boundaries in life. Man is now relegated to toiling soil, which is really difficult. There are thorns now. The soil is hard to work with. Women now are going to have, childbirth is going to be painful. And misery is introduced to the world. And Satan, who, as we seem to understand, was a standing creature, now is near the earth and slithers and crawls. And I'm not sure exactly what that means, but I can sense that he's stuck more to the earth in that. But he doesn't go away. And he doesn't go in our, away in our relationships. Did anybody at your ceremony, wedding ceremony, say these words? That now you're going to be married and you're going to go to war? Did anybody say that to you? I went to a wedding 2 weeks ago and I was waiting to hear those words. They were up there and they exchanged vows and they exchanged rings, but the pastor didn't say it. I was saying, oh, if he could only say it, he might help and save them from a lot of misery. Those words of, you're going to go to war. You're going to go to war with your wife, and you're going to go to war with Satan. And marriage is about conflict. Marriage is about power struggles. But marriage is about growing up, right? Langford's Law. I told you I'd put it in here. Phil and I were having breakfast one morning, and he says, we were talking about Genesis, this very thing, and he said, well, you know, there's Langford's Law. And Langford's Law is this, that we are only 24 hours away of being released from our headship. Now, what does that mean? It means that our wives are probably better at what we do than we are. And you know what? Quite honestly, most oftentimes, they are pained because they don't want to do that. We see Eve stepping forward and actually doing things, and Adam's this passive guy. And yet, we are somewhat in that situation too. We passively wait around to see what's going to happen. Sometimes our wives are the ones that step forward and lead Bible studies and do those kinds of things, and we sit by the wayside. And yet, God has put us in authority. God has put us in a situation where we are called to lead. Now, next week, we're going to talk a little bit more about this, what it means to be a leader, but a suffering servant, different than the world, something that the world would despise. But we oftentimes fall into the same category. Now, there are two types of problems in every marriage. There are solvable problems. Okay? Those are easy. You flip a coin. Who's going to take out the garbage? Well, we'll flip a coin. We'll make it fair. Then there are what I call perpetual problems. Now, every marriage has a set of perpetual problems. But these perpetual problems are connected to a dream. Now, I'm going to give you an example from my relationship with Anne. Many of you know Anne. She's a lovely woman. She's incredible. I guess got married so far over my head, I don't even want to let her know because there's a chance she'd leave me. We've been married 33 years. I don't want to risk it. But it's tied to a dream. And each one of you have perpetual issues with your wives. Anne, as good as she is and as beautiful as she is, tends to leave shoes around the house. Not a big deal. It's not lethal, but it affects me. Now, why does it affect me? Well, because it's tied to a dream that I have. The dream is I was raised in a very lower middle class family. My parents were both teachers. And we lived in a very modest house. Therefore, for people to come to our house and there'd be shoes lying around, it would it would be evidence that these were white trash people. So that's my deep, deep fear, that people will look at me and say, Kim Storm is a white trash kind of guy. Now, I was raised in Spokane, Washington. It was kind of a blue-collar town. It was, you know, I was up there this weekend. It hasn't changed much. It's so far and different from Southern California, you wouldn't believe it. The women look different up there. The people are different up there. It's you could buy a house for $50,000 up there. That's how different it is. But when Ann leaves shoes around, for me, it says, A, you don't love me. You don't care enough. You are making me look bad. Now, Ann was raised in a different family. She was raised in a very upper-class family. She had her own maid. Samantha took care of everything. Samantha picked up her shoes, made her pancakes in the morning, food in the afternoon, and all those kinds of things. For her, it is not a problem. Shouldn't be a problem. It shouldn't define who you are. But I'm fearful that it's going to define me. Now, each of you have situations with your wives that are perpetual, but they're tied to a dream. It may be that your wife's always late. And it signals to you that she disrespects you. We're going to talk a little bit about that next week, about love and respect. But in marriages, what I wanted to talk about today are some things that we need to know as husbands. We need to know about our dreams. We need to know about our wives. We need to know about ourselves. And I'm a little bit behind on... But God's got this design that he is growing us up and putting us in relationships. God values marriage so much that Jesus uses the analogy of his relationship to the church like a marriage. There's a marriage feast of the Lamb coming. Marriage best describes God's relationship with us. And so our marriages are little micros of that. So the world looks at us and says, hey, your marriage is working. What is that? How are you able to do it? How are you able to be different? It becomes a segue for the rest of the world to say, hey, this reflects God's relationship to the world in that way. Okay? Now, we're going to talk a little about roles next week. But why do we need husbands and fathers? Why is God called a father? Now, I believe one of the reasons is women literally could take over the world. And they could probably run it better than we do. But that's not God's design. I think one of the reasons, not the only reason, but I think one of the reasons is because God as a father demands respect. And we have had an experiment for the last 50 years in America, where men have been marginalized in a particular community, and women have been the head of families, and we have seen what has happened in the black community when that happens. What happens is that children are pretty good up until about the age of 9. And then at 9, the boys leave mom, and they look for a central organizing figure. And what do they get involved with? Gangs. Gangs of men are not good. Maybe the Odd Fellows or the Elks are okay. I don't know about that. But for most part, when men gang together, they are not good. They usually are into mischief. Most of the crime in the United States is committed by males between the ages of 18 and 25 that are single. Marriage civilizes men. And God says the father needs to be the head of the household because as younger men grow up, A, they need to learn how to respect and love, but not destroy. So Satan has perpetrated a lie, even in our country, that men are dispensable. The government will take care of you. You know, you can be a single mom. We'll just keep feeding you money. We'll replace men. They aren't needed. And yet we have to be a living example of, yes, we are needed. Our boys are crying out for examples, and they need to be schooled in how to be good fathers, good husbands. And we need to be different. Okay, oftentimes we get this. The woman's up here saying, this line represents my expectations. You know? How many of you feel in trouble most of the time with your wives? Yeah. I'm one of those too. You know, I feel like all the time I'm just coming up a little bit short. She has a different idea about marriage than I. Or how about this one? Now, according to this agreement, his problems will be your problems and your problems will be your problems. Right? We kind of like it that way. Are those lawyers? I guess, okay. What we know, men are defensive. Most of us have a chip on our shoulders. We are problem solvers, we're not listeners. We're very sensitive to respect issues. We're sensitive to power struggles. We're afraid to be wrong, and we're fearful of failure or shame. Does this match your experience in life? Right. Now, we have to understand how we come to marriage. Men are more defensive than women. That means when a woman says something to us that we don't understand, that's confusing, that we're not sure about, our heart rate starts to increase. Because we are responding as if this could be a threat. And our mind is starting to reel with all kinds of, what did I do wrong? And we're already thinking about how we're going to plot our escape. Because when confronted by a woman, not many of us like to sit there. We are trying to think of the quickest answer and how we're going to get out of this situation, because if it were a guy, we could slug him, take him down, do something, but with a woman, we're defenseless. They speak better than we do, they think quicker than we do, and oftentimes, we are at a loss to what they're saying. Right? Okay, it's got to come out, of course, but that doesn't address the deeper problem. In communication, there are four things that kill a marriage: criticism, defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling. Now, I already identified one of these, which is defensiveness. Men are more defensive than women. Guess what? Women are more critical than men. So we have critical women, defensive men, criticized. And most of us experience criticism as nagging, right? Our wife is always nagging us. She's always saying, she's doing this, saying this, saying that. Because women, I think, have a kind of a wider scope on things. They see more things than we do. Have you ever watched your wife as you're sitting down to a meal in a restaurant and a good-looking woman walks in? Now, I might look at the woman, but she is really looking at her. You know, she gives her the one up and down. She looks at her, looks all the way down the, she walks down the hallway in that way. Women are very observant. In fact, she can watch that woman and watch me at the same time. Right? One eye is there and one eye is there. She's looking at this woman. She's seeing how I'm going to react to her in that way. And that feels like criticism to us. And we don't like to be criticized. Now, complaints are about behavior. You didn't take out the garbage. You didn't put the check in the banking account. Those are facts, right? That's about complaints. Women most often have complaints, but we interpret those complaints as criticism. It's a major issue in relationships is that men are so sensitive to complaints, just our behaviors, that we interpret it as criticism. you know, she's nagging on me. She's ragging on me. She's making my life miserable in that way. And for men, we have to not take everything personally. Most of the time, we want to simplify our life. We just want to basically be fed, be sexually satisfied, and be left alone. I could say it much cruder, but that's pretty much the statement. Women, on the other hand, have this incredible need to be connected with. And for men, it's like, yeah, it was a good idea when we were first dating, but now I'm not so sure. I'm going to leave it to other people. You know, have some friends, get some girlfriends, you know, get a knitting club, go to Bunko, do something. Right? But you know, I'm not sure I know how to talk to you. I don't know how to connect with you. But women are looking for this connection, and next week we'll get more into that. We're going to talk about how to connect with them in a way that will absolutely change their view about you. They will no longer see you as a wallet. They will see you as the prince that they thought they would have. Someone to connect with, someone to communicate with. And we as men typically listen to them, and we listen for problems because we're really good at solving problems, but most women don't need their problems solved. They will put out problems just to make communication with you, but then they feel dissatisfied because you're saying, hold it. No, I know what you need to do. You need to do... And then you get this yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. When you hear yes, but, signal to me, has always been, when you hear yes, but, you're missing it. You're missing what she's trying to tell you. Yes, but means you haven't heard me. Now, complaints are okay, but in order to complain, you have to reaffirm someone at a ratio of 5 to 1. Now, it's not 5 to 0, it's 5 to 1. We can have complaints in our relationship, but we have to reaffirm each other 5 to 1. In other words, I can survive someone telling me that I didn't take out the garbage if that spouse has told me, you're a great guy, 5 times. Okay. Now, failing marriages also have a ratio. Their ratio is there is one affirmation to every 1.25 complaints. Now, if you're a pilot, that glide ratio is going down like this. Now, at first, it's not very perceivable, but pretty soon that ratio becomes critical. And pretty soon that plane is going to crash. So we have to spend a lot more time affirming our wives than complaining or being defensive in that way, okay? Questions today. If you were Adam, what would you have said to Eve? Second question, on a scale of controlling to passive, where do you tend to be? And last, what complaints do you take personally as criticisms? So spend a couple minutes around the table and kind of work through these questions, and in about 5 minutes we'll close in prayer.